Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
RIM, Research in Motion, is our company of the day this Monday. Not for what they did, but for what they're not doing. The new CEO at the struggling BlackBerry maker said today, yeah, we're not going to change much. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 23rd of January. Good to have you with us. The smartphone market breaks down roughly along these lines. You got your Android phones, you got your iPhones, Windows phones are in there somewhere, and then you got your BlackBerries. Problem is, fewer and fewer people have BlackBerries today, which is why over the weekend, the co-CEOs of Research in Motion resigned. Torsten Hines is the new guy's name, and if you want to have a sense of what he's going to do to shake things up, pay attention to his first big decision. He said he's going to hire a new marketing guy. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Research in Motion's new leader came under immediate fire from impatient investors for insisting there's no need for, quote, seismic change.
If we continue doing well what we're doing, I see no problems of us being in the top three players.
It sounds like they're going to continue to try to compete against Apple and Google and Microsoft and Nokia and on and on and on. And that is a really tough market.
Forrester research analyst Ted Shadler says the smartphone business is already passing BlackBerry by. Just a few years ago, it controlled up to 90% of the business market. Now, Shadler says Apple and Google have snatched away more than half that business.
You're competing against some really big dollars, so it's hard to keep up. It's just plain old hard to keep up, and they haven't kept up.
Shadler suggests Research in Motion should shift its focus to marketing the unique part of its business, its secure email and communication systems, which many businesses still favor. It could essentially sell that service as an application on other phones. Gartner research analyst Ken Delaney doubts that Apple would give Research in Motion access to its iPhones, but he says Android is an open platform.
It would have that marketplace immediately, and they could add the additional things that they're good at, plus their network, which routes traffic globally very efficiently across the world. That's the kind of radical change I think we need to look at.
At Forrester, Ted Shadler says RIM's new CEO has some time to turn things around, but he needs to start soon.
They've got a lot of revenue, they've got a lot of relationships, they've got a lot of cash. So this is hardly a do-or-die quarter or even year. What it is an important rebuilding year.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Crude oil closed up just a tad in New York this afternoon, just under $100 a barrel. Not bad, all things considered, given that today the Europeans joined the effort to turn the economic screws on Tehran. The European Union announced an Iranian oil embargo. They're not going to buy Iranian crude or products made from it. They're part and parcel, of course, with U.S. financial sanctions. The whole point being to cut Iran off from the global economy. But how do you do that? From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong says it's easy. You just make companies understand dealing with Iran just ain't worth it.
The sanctions will cut off European buyers of Iranian oil. Another target, the banks that process Iran oil deals. Washington plans to cut them off from the American market. And without banking middlemen, buyers like India are already hurting, says Amrita Sen at Barclays Capital.
India doesn't want to necessarily stop buying Iranian crude, but Turkey, which is what India channels its payments through, is already saying that we can't take your payments because we don't want to be sanctioned by the U.S.
A third target, Iran's central bank. Its assets are frozen by the Europeans. And fewer oil exports means less foreign currency coming in, which could throw the Iranian currency, the rial, into freefall. Trevor Hauser at the Rhodium Group says it's already happening.
If I'm an Iranian and I have my savings in rial, I'm not so sure about the long-term value of those rial savings. Then I try to move my money over to dollars. And as more Iranians demand dollars, the value of the rial plummets.
European sanctions, like America's, will phase in over 6 months, which leaves time for Iran to find loopholes. Dubai consultant Robin Mills.
The question would be whether Iranian cargoes are going to be disguised or whether there's going to be swaps with kind of friendly third-party countries to enable Iranian oil to get relabeled or get mixed with other oil or whatever to disguise its origin.
Years ago, Iraq got around embargoes, and now with oil at a premium, he expects Iran to try too. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, practically nothing to speak of. All three major indices ended darn near right where they started. Details, numbers, when we get there. forget the senators and the representatives and everybody else who's going to be in the Capitol tomorrow night as President Obama gives his State of the Union speech. You got prime time in an election year and national television coverage. The thing's got politics written all over it, and the politics this year is all economic, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains.
The president's aides say populism and equity will be major themes in the speech. We'll hear a pitch for more education and job opportunities for the middle class, paid for by those who already have a generous slice of the American pie. Despite 4 years of economic backsliding, the president is being advised to accentuate recent positive economic news. William Galston at the Brookings Institution has been looking at speeches by other sitting presidents running for re-election.
If you look at the way Ronald Reagan, for example, began his 1984 State of the Union address.
And I'm pleased to report that America is much improved. And there's good reason to believe that improvement will continue for the days to come.
And so in one simple sentence, he reminded Congress that the country had been through a very difficult period, but the past year had been one of great progress, and there was reason to believe that that would continue.
Galston suggests Obama should point to improving job conditions and offer the prospect of more, with infrastructure building projects and cheaper job training and college education. But Republicans have the congressional clout to block the president's initiatives. Former Republican Congressman Vin Weber says this year Obama will have to meet them partway. His suggestion? Energy.
There's a huge opportunity for us now in terms of conventional fossil fuels, offshore drilling and fracking and natural gas that have the potential to change the equation very favorably in the energy marketplace for the country. And if the president took a couple steps on any aspect of that toward the Republicans, I think that'd be pretty well received.
Finally, White House aides say the most ambitious initiative in the State of the Union aims to trim the number of home foreclosures. Obama hopes to announce a settlement with mortgage lenders that will toss a life preserver to underwater homeowners. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you've been paying attention to the Republican nomination race, you might have heard the name Saul Alinsky quite a bit lately. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani used it to describe Newt Gingrich's criticism of Mitt Romney and the way Romney ran Bain Capital, and not in a nice way, I should add. Gingrich himself has brought Alinsky up more than once as a fair comparison to President Obama.
The founding fathers of America are the source from which we draw our understanding of America. He draws his from Saul Alinsky.
It fits the model of Alinsky radicalism.
A Saul Alinsky radical who is incompetent cannot be reelected.
Nobody's ever gone back and looked at what Saul Alinsky stands for. Nobody ever asked what neighborhood organizer meant.
So we figured we'd do that, ask who Saul Alinsky was. For that, we've called Bob Bruno. He's a professor of labor at the University of Illinois. Bob, welcome to the broadcast.
It's good to be here.
So who was Saul Alinsky? Who is this guy? Or was this guy?
Yeah, so Saul Alinsky was perhaps the modern founder of community organizing, working with dispossessed, powerless groups of people, very often minority populations, working class populations, who needed to organize as a way to bring their voice within the political system. And he created and theorized a way to go about community organizing that spread across the country.
It sounds, to hear Speaker Gingrich say it, like Saul Alinsky wanted nothing less than armed rebellion and the overthrow of American life. Is that true?
No, not even the overthrow of life in Chicago. he actually was quite pragmatic, quite a conservative guy. He understood being very strategic, very tactful. He understood at the end of the day, all groups had to reach a deal. And the idea behind that was motivating Alinsky was to create a people's organization that could represent average people at the bargaining table. So he really was about compromise. It's just that he understood that from the grassroots, people would have to organize to do that.
So factoring in political hyperbole, how much sense does it make for Mr. Gingrich to be bringing this up in discussing President Obama and his past as a community organizer? I mean, that's where this is all coming from.
Right. Well, it makes no sense at all if you're trying to accurately shed some light on the character and the motivating principles of the current president. The president spent a little bit of time doing community organizing, but nobody would say that he was a Saul Alinsky, although Alinsky, along with many other people, would have perhaps helped to shape his principles of governance. But if Gingrich is all about trying to rally a politically conservative base to somehow tinge the president with some sort of radical ideology, then throwing people like Saul Alinsky out into the public domain makes some political sense.
Well, how about this? I mean, you could fairly say that the Tea Party uses some of Saul Alinsky's tactics, right?
You know, the Tea Party is certainly an interesting phenomena. In many ways, the leaders of a multitude of community groups around the country have been trained in the theories and strategies that were developed by Saul Alinsky. But the issues in which they're pursuing, which always had to do with extending liberties and extending forms of social justice to underserved communities, you'd find, you know, great dissimilarities with the Tea Party.
Saul Alinsky died a number of years ago, right?
1972, heart attack.
If he comes back to life today from the great beyond and looks around, is there something that he looks at and says, that's what I was talking about?
The whole question of inequality and the lack of political participation and maybe sovereignty has now become the number one political issue in America. In that sense, Alinsky's got to feel as if his message was heard by lots of people, both on the left and apparently on the right.
Bob Bruno, he's a professor at the University of Illinois School of Labor and Employment Relations. Bob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
Coming up in the Philippines, too many people, not enough food.
There will be doubling of the population, there will be overcrowding of people, there will be a survival of the fittest.
Our series, Food for 9 Billion, continues. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street took a break from its recent rally amid worries once again that Greece might not be able to avoid default. The Dow Industrials edged down 11 points, less than a tenth percent, closed at 12,708. The NASDAQ off 2 points, also less than a tenth percent, 2,784. The S&P 500 was flat, held steady at 1,316. Investors seem none too pleased with that semi-shakeup at Research in Motion that Bob Moon was telling us about. Shares of the BlackBerry maker fell 8.5% on this Monday. After the EU ban of Iranian crude imports, shares of Chevron bubbled up 10%, but ConocoPhillips trickled down nearly 1%. ExxonMobil closed pretty much flat. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.05%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve holds its first scheduled meeting of the year on interest rates and the economy. The House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Social Security holds a hearing on the future of the disability insurance program. And nominations for the 84th Academy Awards are announced in Beverly Hills. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We've been airing a commentary series the past couple of weeks or so. It's called My Life is True, from people living on the edges of the economy. Today, Jose Arreola and a secret he's decided not to keep.
We had to decide whether we were going north or south to get into California. My friend decided it would be best to go south to avoid the big snowstorm up north. But south would take us through Arizona. I really, really didn't want to go through Arizona. I got more and more nervous. I felt paralyzed. My friend kept asking me what my problem was. Finally, I told him. I'm undocumented. I came to the United States when I was 3 with my family. And Arizona had just passed a law that gave police officers the authority to check people's immigration status. If we got stopped in Arizona, I could be detained and deported. My friend is white. He comes from a really privileged upper-class background. He attended a private high school, then Santa Clara University with me. I went on scholarship. Politically, he sees things a little differently than I do. We've had our disagreements. He was quiet for a while. Then he barraged me with questions. I answered the best I could. Silence again. Then he told me about his grandfather, how he hadn't been able to find work in Ireland, so he decided to hop on a fishing boat and get off in New York. He worked as a janitor without citizenship. Now his son, my friend's father, is a high-ranking bank executive. The whole time through Arizona, my friend drove like 50 miles an hour. He didn't even want to change lanes. He told me he wasn't going to lose his best friend. He wasn't going to let that happen. The immigration debate became real to my friend in the car that day. We had a very different conversation than the one politicians are having right now. The minute actual undocumented immigrants are included, the conversation always changes. Now I'm completely open about my status. I'm still afraid. Conversations don't always go well, and it's always a risk. But as long as I remain in the shadows, I will never really get to know you, and you'll never really know me.
Jose's story comes to us from My Life is True. That's a project of the New America Foundation. Let us know what you think. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says contact. Over the past 50 years, the amount of food that we as a planet produce has doubled. So too has the number of people who depend on that food. There are 7 billion of us now. The United Nations says we're on the way to 9 billion by the middle of the century. So that's what we're calling our year-long series on how we're going to feed them all. Food for 9 billion is a partnership with Homelands Productions, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and PBS NewsHour. And last month, we took you to Egypt and the realities of food and revolution. Today, the Philippines, where a growing population means the country can't feed itself anymore. And that leaves them with two options: increase supply and try to do something about demand. From outside Manila, Sam Eaton reports.
There's a saying in the Philippines, pantawid gutom. It means to cross the hunger. When a family can't afford rice, they'll water down a pack of instant noodles or feed their babies brown sugar dissolved in water to ease the hunger pangs. The fact that this saying even exists should tell you something about what it means to be poor here. Clarissa Kanayang is 42 years old. She has 10 surviving children, the youngest only a year old. And she lives in an urban Manila slum called Vitas, at the edge of a garbage dump.
Normally, you have 3 meals in a day, but sometimes we eat only once. Other times, the children just have bread twice a day because we don't have money.
Kanayang's house, her food, all the money she earns, around $7 a day on the good days, comes from garbage. Her family picks through the trash heap to find things they can use or sell. She's lost 4 of her children to measles and dengue fever. This is the face of population growth, and not just here in the Philippines. Most of the world's next 2 billion people will be born into conditions similar to these, in countries already struggling to feed their populations. On the other side of Manila, workers load sacks of imported Vietnamese rice onto trucks. The bags are stacked 50 feet high in the sprawling government warehouse. The Philippines' population, today just shy of 100 million, has tripled since the high-yielding rice varieties bumped up production back in the 1960s. And in order to feed all of those extra mouths, the country has become the biggest importer of rice on the planet.
Right now, the Philippines is already beyond its carrying capacity.
Ernesto Pernia is the former lead economist for the Asia Development Bank.
Otherwise, we would be doing well. We would not just be muddling through. The fact that we have been muddling through is we have overreached.
And that overreach Pernia refers to shows little sign of slowing. Today, about 2 million babies are born every year in the Philippines, many of them here at Manila's Jose Fabila Memorial Hospital. Its maternity ward is one of the busiest in the world, with 2, sometimes 3 mothers for every bed. Dr. Esmeraldo Ilim, head of the hospital's family planning unit, says it wasn't supposed to be this way.
We are supposed to be seeing less and less of these women getting pregnant, but that does not happen.
In neighboring Thailand, for example, a long history of government-supported family planning has caused fertility and poverty rates to plummet there. It's also paved the way for Thailand to become one of the world's biggest rice exporters. But in the Philippines, the availability of birth control still depends solely on donations from foreign governments and nonprofits. And as international donors such as USAID cut funding for these programs, hospitals like this one are left scrambling for supplies. Elim says if the situation doesn't change,
there will be doubling of the population, there will be overcrowding of people, there will be a survival of the fittest.
It's a hell of a problem.
That's Filipino Congressman Walden Bello. He says demographers expect that doubling of the Philippines' population to happen sometime before the end of the century. And that's only if something is done to close the birth control gap, especially among the poor, more than a quarter of whom have no access at all.
We're running out of time. Our window of opportunity is closing up fast. Fortunately speaking, people, you know, both among the poor and the middle classes are beginning to realize that, my God, we've got to get hold of this.
Bello's been trying to pass a reproductive health bill in Congress for more than a decade so that women at least have the tools to choose their family size. It would offer universal access to birth control for the first time in the Philippines' history. But there's a reason it's been languishing in the halls of Congress.
From contraception, abortion comes. It's just one step below.
Filipino Archbishop Emeritus Oscar Cruz is a staunch opponent of the bill. He and the Catholic Church say it represents the interests of multinational pharmaceutical giants, not the people, 80% of whom are Catholic. All over the Philippines, churches have plastered political banners on their facades. They've even threatened the president with excommunication.
That's why I say don't fool with the church, because she will bury you.
These warnings that the church will bury anyone opposed to its views point to just how much the issue of population growth, here and all over the world for that matter, is a battle of ideologies rather than economics or science. For Cruz and many others who oppose efforts to curb population growth, the solution is simple. Grow more food. It worked in the past with the Green Revolution, so why wouldn't it work again?
I think that in many ways we're facing challenges that dwarf what we were facing in the 1960s.
That's Robert Ziegler, director of the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines. This is where those high-yielding rice strains were first developed. Ziegler says with climate change and an increasingly crowded planet, the huge increases of the past may be harder to come by this time around.
I don't think there's any question that we will want to feed these people. We want them to be well-fed and want them to be well-nourished and we want them to be healthy. At the same time, we have to do this in a way that once populations do stabilize, that the world we live in is a place we want to live in.
And this is where things get tricky. Ziegler says the demand for rice is expected to grow anywhere from 50 to 70% in the coming years. Meeting that demand without jeopardizing the planet's remaining ecosystems will take a level of coordination and foresight unprecedented in human history. For him, the technological holy grail is a bioengineered, photosynthesis-supercharged rice strain. But such a breakthrough is decades away, if at all. And in the meantime, the Philippines and much of the world is losing productive farmland, not adding it. I followed a caravan of protesting farmers in Nueva Ecija, the rice basket of the Philippines. Their land, some of the most productive in the country, is set to be paved over by a new highway and industrial park. As cities all across the country expand, the displaced often end up migrating to urban slums. Once here, they enter a cycle of poverty that's nearly impossible to break. Population growth among poor Filipinos is twice the national average. And for women like Clarissa Canayong, the mother of 10 I spoke with earlier, her inability to provide enough food and to pay for her children's education all but guarantees she and her family will remain poor.
One of my kids already has a suitor. I told her, Danica, please don't have a boyfriend just yet. You know very well of our situation. Do you want to get married at a young age and end up just like me?
I asked Canayong if she could do it all over again, how many children she would have wanted. Her answer? 2. A recent study by the Guttmacher Institute found that the cost of providing birth control to the quarter billion women on the planet who want it but don't have access to it is about $4.5 a year per person. But it could mean having 8 billion mouths to feed by the end of the century instead of 15 billion. That's the United Nations low and high fertility projections for global population growth. It's a huge spread. But the only difference between those numbers is an average of one less or one more child per woman. So maybe solving the world's food problem isn't just about solving the world's food problem. It's also about giving women the tools they want so they can make the decisions they want here in the world's poorest places. In the Philippines, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Sam filed a second story from the Philippines, this time with pictures. It's on the NewsHour tonight about how overfishing is adding to the problems over there. And there's more on our website. It includes an interactive map breaking down the Global Food Challenge country by country. You can check it out at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the Marketplace entry in the Sometimes Super PACs Do More Harm Than Good sweepstakes. The Super PAC that's supporting Ron Paul, Revolution PAC, it's called, is out with a new fundraising idea today. A collectible action figure of the candidate himself. I could stop there, but this is just really too good. For $94.95 plus $7.50 shipping and handling, you can get either Commander-in-Chief Ron Paul or Superman Ron Paul, dressed appropriately. They are 12 inches tall, the website tells us. Comes equipped with a mini U.S. Constitution also. And it says this, it comes fully clothed. So there's that. You kind of have to see it to believe it. We've got pictures, marketplace.org, if you want to have a look. All right, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, this Monday. Today, the Dow down 11 points, less than a tenth percent. The NASDAQ off 2 points, also less than a tenth percent. The S&P 500 added a fraction of a point. That is 1/20 of 1%, if you're keeping track. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up tomorrow on the broadcast, a year after the Arab Spring, the ties to Occupy Wall Street.
I think that sparked the imagination of people on the left and younger people in the United States that we could do something besides conventional politics.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us. This is APM, that's American Public Media.